Topical cream, a pod listener.
When the world is a mean and nasty little place, finding the truth can be a little tricky.
Yeah, that mishmash was because Max can't figure out what kind of episode this is, but expects us to figure out how to produce it. So here we are. And there you go. Anyway, let's begin.
Hey, and fuckers, we're taking a different swing at things today because I got a little distracted with a couple of news stories this week that caught my attention. So I'm nearly finished with the final installment of our Border Crisis series, but I'm pausing to bring you these two stories that appeared on our YouTube. We also have an extended post-show musings at the conclusion as kind of a stand-in for show notes this week as well. So we'll get to that in a minute. There's so much to cover these days, so I hope you don't mind me changing things up just to kind of keep on top of everything. So one thing to draw your attention to during our spring Fund Friend and Hellraiser period is another free way that you can support us if financial support isn't in the cards right now. And that is our newsletter. So our weekly newsletter is one of the fastest growing features that we have, and it's a great way to stay on top of all things UNFTR and important news to progressives. You can help by circulating it to friends, talking about it online, and encouraging people to sign up for it. Of course, we're also dialing for dollars this period, so if you are in a position to support UNFTR by becoming a sustaining member or giving a one-time donation, it would be greatly appreciated. Members receive a second newsletter every Tuesday that we produce in partnership with the team over at Newsbeat, and that one is also fantastic. Comrade and above members receive a monthly sticker pack lovingly designed by 99. Yes, a sticker sheet with original designs mailed to you every single month, and an invitation to attend the monthly hang with Max, that's me, where we live stream to members only. We put a ton of thought behind delivering value with our memberships, so hopefully you can become part of the UNFTR universe. Now, here's what got me sidetracked this week, starting with AOC. In the past, you've heard me offer a full-throated defense of Representative Ocasio-Cortez, the bête noire of the Republican establishment, and too often, the Democratic establishment as well. I've listened to the objections of corporate Democrats to her youth, her tactics, her priorities, her dancing, her dress, you name it. And more recently, we've heard the objections of progressives who claim she's caving in to the status quo. Well, if that's the case, she's not going to earn any marks from progressives for her recent contribution of $260,000 for the Democratic Party's Voter Protection Program, an initiative designed to register voters and preserve voting integrity. It's also a rainy day fund for the inevitable legal challenges the Republicans will mount in the coming election and most likely beyond. Then again, her PAC has also committed $500,000 to defending squad members. Bottom line is AOC is a fundraising machine, and she has been since she ousted Joe Crowley. According to Open Secrets, the Congresswoman has raised $6.5 million in this election cycle alone. And she's still sitting on $6 million in cash on hand, despite having spent a little more than $5.5 million because she's been stockpiling cash since 2019 and outraising her colleagues by orders of magnitude. Here's why I don't listen to criticism from fellow leftists when it comes to AOC, not that anyone is infallible. AOC is a titan in the making. Think about it. She's only 34 years old and already one of the most recognizable figures in America. She makes bold choices, not all of them terrific, but always eye-catching and headline-grabbing. She's polarizing because the higher her profile goes, the more villainized she is by the right, and the more she scares the centrists. And if you look at her voting record, by the way, it's as far left as it gets. So not only is she beating the House members in the recognition game, she's beating them at their game, the money game. And not in a Marjorie Taylor Greene way by fear-mongering and stupidity, but through advocating and teaching. One of the most underrated aspects of her tenure that's lost on people like my demographic is how she engages with her 8 million followers on Instagram. She's a teacher and a guide, lets them know what's happening behind closed doors, and literally teaches young people about the legislative process. I mean, it's a masterclass in community engagement and public square advocacy for the modern age. And she's peerless in this regard. Now, critics within the establishment are quick to diminish her, saying she's a lone voice on the far left, but she's a ranking member on the vital Oversight and Reform Committee, where she has set herself apart by coming prepared, bringing receipts, and scoring points with intelligence and bravado. Even Republicans admit that she's a force to be reckoned with on this committee, with many backing down from high-profile spats for fear of retribution from her legions of followers. I see in Ocasio-Cortez a seasoned politician beyond her years in both life and in office who is carefully crafting a standout role in an aging party. Time is on her side. You know, it wasn't long ago that Nancy Pelosi was chiding her in private and in public. Did AOC throw a tantrum or pull the bullshit that the Freedom Caucus has done on the other side of the aisle? I mean, they're once again, right now, in the middle of trying to throw out Mike Johnson after just throwing out Kevin McCarthy. Well, no. She waited and raised a lot of money and stayed in the public eye. The Pelosis of the world are fading away as a younger generation moves in, which is not to say that things will get better. It's just that seasoned politicians who know their way around the Beltway and have lost enough battles to learn how to win them are the ones who eventually call the shots, especially if they become fundraising machines like AOC. Now that she's spreading the wealth, and in a very specific way, she's basically announced the next chapter in her career. For those who expected more from her and want her to vote against every single thing either party puts on the table, you're missing the point. If you want pure principle, that's for activists like Medea Benjamin, Nina Turner, Angela Davis, Christian Smalls, and Ralph Nader. When you elect representatives, you're looking for people on the inside who understand how to pull the levers and make deals. There are 435 of these assholes, and our job is to find the assholes who know when to pucker and when to make a stink. And if you're looking for bomb throwers to dismantle the system, that's not what this is. From minute one, when James Madison was struggling to find common ground with slave-owning colony representatives, it was decided that we would have something called the Senate that would serve as the great cooling mechanism that restricted purely ideological instincts. Now, do I think that AOC and the squad should have and could have done more to protect the most important provisions in the Build Back Better bill and force Biden's hand? You bet. AOC was elected in 2019, though, and Build Back Better was just 2021. That's a lot to put on someone who's been in the job for 2 years. And oh, by the way, the squad is just the House. There's that prickly little thing again called the Senate, and at the time we had Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin to contend with, and so promises were broken. Compromises were made, and we got what we got. But guess what? Manchin? Leaving. Sinema? Leaving. Pelosi? Just another rank-and-file member. If you're not patient, then politics isn't for you. Agitation, activism, protest, these things happen outside the system to raise enough awareness and noise that the people inside the system respond. And the great equalizer in this equation in the past couple of decades, however, has been money. Money beats protest all day, every day. But now, this 34-year-old, with only 5 years under her belt, has managed to raise more than $37 million since first getting elected. 8 million followers, 37 million raised, prime committee assignment. AOC's not selling out. She's taking over. And the best thing that we can do is stay out of her way, back her play, and let her continue to grow into the role. One by one, the old guard will retire, fade away, or just die. And if it comes to the point when she loses the plot and sells her soul, then we can protest and agitate against her. But until that time, I'll leave you with this before we move on to the second story. The historical corollary that I drew in the longer AOC piece, and you've heard me tell before, but it bears repeating. When Rosa Luxemburg challenged the establishment socialists of her time, she too built coalitions and fought within her parties. She challenged the likes of Karl Kautsky in her home country and Lenin and Trotsky in Russia. She threw herself into the challenges of the day when it wasn't yet clear whether capitalism would survive, when there was a real opportunity for a socialist revolution from Russia to Latin America, but when leftists wanted to revolt against the German SPD to spread the revolutionary flames that burned in Russia and topple the German government, Luxemburg preached caution. She said Germany wasn't ready, that the revolutionary conditions were not yet prime in Germany, much to the chagrin of revolutionaries who ultimately ignored her and attempted a coup anyway. And in the midst of it, Luxemburg was murdered. Her body was thrown into the river and her memory largely forgotten to history. No statues, no movies, no holidays. But sometimes it seems as though nothing short of this type of martyrdom will suffice for leftists, and that AOC is the avatar that they're choosing to project their armchair criticisms upon. But take heed of Bloody Rosa, and remember that this isn't a chess match. In America, it's high-stakes poker, and the minimum bid is in the millions. Well, now, there's a new player at the high-stakes table who will not be denied.
That brings us to the second distraction this week, Donald Trump's increasing favorability ratings. Although the top story about Trump should be the rumor that he apparently stinks like shit. Here we go.
As the days roll on and we get simultaneously closer to the election and further away from Trump's presidency, the tiny hand orange face butt puckers' favorability ratings are increasing. A joint New York Times-Siena poll has the former president's favorable ratings 2 points higher than the current president. Now, it's only been 3 years, but the country's actually getting nostalgic for the Donald, or at least it looks like it. Now, this is the kind of sentimental turn that typically takes decades to pull off. So is this surprising? Well, yes and no. Barack Obama secured his first term with a popular vote margin of 10 million. Obama fever swept the nation, and the world for that matter. I mean, he was given a Nobel Peace Prize in his first year for basically doing nothing. Because the country was pulling out of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, Americans had a big appetite for all that hope and change that we had coming to us. By the next election, Mitt Romney managed to shave the margin, and Obama won re-election by about 5 million. By 2016, America had enough of Obama's steady Eddie routine and decided to vote for a reality television star with no experience, a litany of bankruptcies, and a slew of public sex scandals. So what's wrong with us? Is it a uniquely American trait to suffer from extreme electoral amnesia? Well, not really. I mean, it's definitely in our DNA, but it's not exclusive to us. For example, in 2021, the Levada Center released a poll that revealed that more than half of Russians polled think Stalin was a great leader. It's estimated that Stalin straight up murdered about 1 million Soviet citizens in gulags, by the way, and somewhere between another 6 and 9 million through forced starvation and incarceration. Nazis have also made a resurgence in Eastern Europe and sadly in corners of our little democratic experiment. There are Chileans who pine for the days of Pinochet. You know who gets this? McDonald's. McDonald's and the makers of Malamars. There's a reason that the McRib only shows up every few years and synthetic Malamars are marketed as seasonal. Anyway, if the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world that he didn't exist, then the greatest trick Trump ever pulled was convincing half of this country that he didn't do it. Whatever it is. Except when he admits to doing it, in which case it's fine. I mean, he initiated Operation Warp Speed to help bring the COVID vaccine to market, then convinced people not to take it. Or take it. I mean, he did, except that he didn't. Bleach and UV rays, maybe. I don't know. A lot of people say that it's a cure, along with horse medication. But take the vaccine. Or don't take the vaccine. Definitely don't boost. No booster. And no mandate. Except that they mandated it. I mean, even if you take the pandemic out of the equation, Trump gave everyone whiplash because he stands for nothing. He floated ideas from assassinations and nuking hurricanes to raking leaves from the forest floor to stop wildfires. Every single day, a new bonkers headline. And it's not that some of us have forgotten. I mean, there are those who never stop loving Trump, but for the fence sitters, it's too early for nostalgia to kick in for most people. The Trump bump is something a little different. It's what Obama was contending with in his second election. It's momentum versus incrementalism. When we talk about historical epics, there are a few in this nation. Revolutionary America, pre-industrial America, Depression era, post-World War II boom, the Civil Rights era, the 50-year neoliberal era. But I think when we look back through history, we're going to see that the financial crisis was the end of the neoliberal era, and 2009 was the beginning of something different. From a political and economic perspective, we can see the change in how we legislate as an example. Because of the way that Congress is structured and the fact that compromise is dead, we've moved to governing by omnibus. Everything big gets done in the afterglow of an election, presuming there's a legislative majority to push through an executive agenda. Now, Obama used his political capital at that time to pass the ACA. Trump used his to push through tax cuts for the wealthy. And Biden used his on the Inflation Reduction Act and infrastructure bills. The Obama terms gave us Trump because of the incremental nature of this period. After the $787 billion stimulus in the ACA, nothing moved quickly under Obama. The Republicans basically organized to beat back most of the promised agenda, and the Obama team just worked as technocrats from that point forward to institutionalize the ACA and stabilize the economy. But because a third of that stimulus went to the states, and a third went to extending unemployment benefits, the final third only went to stabilizing the broader economy, so it didn't do much in the way of moving the middle class forward or lifting people out of poverty. It just wasn't enough. The Trump tax cuts, mixed with a protracted zero interest rate environment, gave an appearance of forward momentum, if only because it caused the markets to rip and overheat a little bit. But the pandemic laid waste to every policy in its path and left the Trump administration in a state of desperation. Now, the Orange Cheetos personal management style aside, a couple of really important things happened. One was Steve Mnuchin's PPP program that flooded small and medium-sized business markets with capital. Then there were the direct stimulus payments right into people's pockets, the moratorium on evictions. And on the big stuff, the Fed was able to revive a suite of financial crisis-era programs to backstop the markets with liquidity. It was all pretty ugly, it was frenetic, at times lopsided and sloppy. But what's fascinating is that, pound for pound, Biden's omnibus accomplishments are way greater than his predecessors of this new era. It's just that the investments are mostly into the physical rather than the human, and therefore harder to feel on a personal level and more protracted. Now compare that with what happened at the end of Trump's term. Trump's mismanagement of the pandemic plunged the country and household wealth into the abyss. And within months, the government covered it all and then some. A combination of socialist-style welfare policies and extraordinary Keynesian interventions gave the country a different kind of whiplash. From the depths of despair, social and fiscal welfare policies saved the nation. And for the first time since the post-World War II boom, most people were a little better off than before. I mean, those who were still alive and, you know, didn't try to cure themselves of COVID by drinking bleach. But I know most people on my side of the political spectrum can't bring themselves to compliment the Trump administration for anything, but I think that's dumb. They should be complimented for rolling out and managing one of the greatest examples of socialist economic policy the world has ever seen. Think about it. Eviction protection, direct child welfare payments, suspension of student debt payments, infusions of capital into small businesses completely written off and forgiven, free vaccines, extended unemployment benefits, universal health care. This country isn't nostalgic for Trump. It's yearning for social democracy. It just doesn't know to call it that. Trump's momentum was socialist. So maybe that's the greatest trick the devil ever pulled off.
It's the end of the episode where we used to do show notes. The show notes. Calling out what we should have done instead. Oh, post show notes.
No. Now that you've agitated me.
We're in post show musings right now. We're just picking up midstream on a not argument. But 99 made a very declarative statement, as she does, a broad sweeping generalization.
Wow, are you making fun of me because I say that all the time?
She said all new music comes out on Fridays. And the reason she's thinking about that, all new music comes out at midnight on Friday. And the reason she's thinking about that is because apparently you're hearing this on Saturday. So now Taylor Swift is dropping another album. So she would be, by the time you're hearing this, a full day and a half into listening to the new Taylor album. And I just asked if it was new or if it was going to be more regurgitated stuff of her trying to take back control of all of her original things. And she got really snide after that. And now here we are in post-show musings, another fight because of Taylor Swift, the great divider.
Well, you've agitated me. You acted like I made up the concept of New Music Friday.
Right, music pretty fun fact. This was sort of something that Beyonce made happen. So again, power to the women for flipping the music industry on its collective patriarchal head.
Did she tease any? Because I think you did.
I did. That's what. Check Spotify, Grandpa. Okay. Where does the music come from? Do I listen at the top or the bottom?
Do you?
How far away do I hold my phone from my ear?
Did she release any teasers? Do you have any idea of what the new music's going to sound like?
Not a clue.
Billy Joel did when he released his new song after 35 years of not writing one.
Yeah, it sounds like all the other ones.
It does.
So we didn't really need a teaser.
So no teasers, huh?
No.
You have no idea?
Nope.
Could it be like a, what if it's like a radical departure like Beyonce's latest album? What if she comes out with like a Swedish death metal style album?
I would love that.
Would you?
I think so.
Okay.
I think I support her unconditionally as long as she's mostly unproblematic.
Okay.
There's some conditionals in there, but.
Yeah, okay.
I stand by her side. Maybe it wouldn't be the album for me, but I respect her ability to explore new genres and introduce new people to new genres, much as Beyonce is doing with hopefully introducing a new group of people to country and also a new group of country people to Beyonce.
All right.
Do they like being called country people?
Country music fans, sure. Shit kickers, cowboys and cowgirls, cowpokes.
Cow people?
Yeah, cow people. So Trump apparently stinks like shit.
I didn't. Yeah, this is news to me. I mean, like, if you had asked me before, like, what do you think Trump smells like? I wouldn't have said anything good. Probably like an old gym sock.
I actually would have assumed
and, like, that hairspray.
He would just smell fake. Like, it would be like a lot of fragrances.
He wears Axe.
Like an Axe mixed with like hairspray and I don't know.
What was the old hairspray? The Aquanet, is that what it was called?
Aquanet and what did my parents put when aerosol was still legal? What did they have? I could see the label. Very distinct smell. Anyway, my dad like rocked a proper fro back in the 70s and early 80s. And there was a lot of hairspray in our house, like a lot.
Uganda.
Hmm?
Uganda.
I thought you said Uganda. I was like, okay.
yeah, let's segue.
Okay. Jeez. Yeah, so he stinks like shit and he's falling asleep.
Do you think at his own trials. Light? Like, is it literal shit?
I wonder, is he rotting? Is he?
Maybe he's farting a lot. You know, that happens in old people. Their buttholes just get loose and they don't realize they're farting.
Maybe.
And I doubt if he's eating only McDonald's.
Oh, God.
Then like if you're eating, what do they have at McDonald's? Big Macs, right? That's them. So if you're eating like 4 Big Macs a day, maybe like 3 hash browns, probably regular Coke for him. I doubt
he's probably got the meat sweats.
I don't even know if it counts as the meat sweats when it's just McDonald's. I think it's just like the grease sweats.
Yeah.
So it's a teenager who's cleaned a grill. What are they called? Griddles? Skillet? Mm-hmm. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Like that smell, the griddle smell seeping out of him mixed with whatever his body, how it's metabolizing the, you know, it's not poison if you have one every now and again. I support eating all the foods you want in moderation.
Okay.
But probably just don't eat like a bunch of McDonald's every day.
Which so, you know, it is fascinating how once you get the taste of it, it can become, it gets implanted in there in an addictive sort of way. Like,
oh, that's how I'm with Taco Bell.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never had Taco Bell.
Oh, my God.
I know.
If I eat Taco Bell, I like need it tomorrow. Like it's very, I'm like, I want Taco Bell.
Yeah.
Even if it makes my stomach hurt.
I was at driving back from dropping my daughter off and, this I think like 2 years ago. And so I pulled over to get gas and I saw the McDonald's sign and I was like, I was like a man possessed. I was like, I need a Big Mac. I hadn't had a Big Mac in probably 15 years. I was like, I have to have this right now.
Was it worth it?
Yeah, I was so satiated afterwards.
Even before I didn't eat meat, I wasn't like a burger person. Mm. So I'd eat like chicken nuggets. So I don't know if I've ever really had like a McDonald's burger or like a Whopper, I guess.
Yeah.
They look like shit.
My electric chair meal. My last meal is French toast.
Challah French toast?
No. Classic, traditional, thin French toast.
Challah French toast.
With a lot of confectionery sugar on it. Real maple syrup and sausage patties, not Link's patties.
Okay.
The real, real processed ones. And then I would wash that down with Big Mac so that partially because, you know, I just would enjoy a Big Mac at the end of my life. And also because I know for sure then I would shit myself when they electrocuted me and then they'd have to clean up after me.
Oh, so you're intending to shit yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would want it to be the worst thing. I'd want to smell like Trump on trial when they did that to me.
Did Trump on trial. I don't think I have.
So this guy falls a fucking sleep, stinks like shit. And
he's a baby.
Point
That's
is
literally baby.
He's literally a baby. The point is he's getting more free media than ever before. He is not bothered one iota by this trial, by his many trials, because every time he shows up for trial, it's front fucking page news. And he just gets, we're doing it again. We're giving this guy free earned media. I mean, wall to wall.
I can't remember if I read a headline or if it was a podcast, but they said like the symbolism of OJ dying and then the Trump trials, you know, being covered in the media. It's like one door closes, another door opens.
Yeah. Pretty incredible. Pretty incredible. I watched the, oh man, what a terrible late night rabbit hole to go down. It was a montage of every single SNL joke about OJ that Norm MacDonald made.
I thought it was going to be every time OJ essentially admitted he did it.
No.
There's a lot.
Too, yeah. 16 straight minutes of him doing it got him fired. That's eventually what got him fired from SNL. It was 16 straight minutes of jokes. Every single week he told one after the other, and they asked him to stop doing it. And he kept doing it. And then the head of the network finally came in and said, it's enough, because the guy was friends with OJ. But he was relentless.
No one is safe, quote unquote. No. Except whoever lines Lorne Michaels' pockets.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, so
I think you made really good points, though. I mean, in the piece about people feeling more secure, you know, it's something we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. People feel like my life was better then. I also think we're at it, shockingly, at a phase where we're actually romanticizing the pandemic in a way.
Yep.
Like,
absolutely.
You know, now that life is busy again and 24/7 news media and more war than we had at that point, people are like, wow, things were simple. You know, they just, it, so quickly we forget that it was filled with death and despair, depression, and isolation. But it felt simpler, I guess, in people's minds. It's like, it's romanticizing being off the grid, you know, the same kind of thing, but we actually lived it. So alongside those sentimental feelings come the feeling of security, at least for some people.
And we do. And we do have this weird brain melt when it comes to trying to place things in history with specific moments in time. Like, you know, where the Trump supporters that were like, oh, 9/11 was Obama's greatest failure. Like, what? And, you know, people thinking that, you know, well, you know, at least Trump got Osama bin Laden. Like, there are real weird sentiments out there about who did what and when happened, what happened when, you know?
I always just thought it was intentional ignorance. Like, how does anyone think that Obama was president during 9/11?
It's amazing.
So that's what I've never understood, that those people can't be serious.
He was like in law school.
Yeah. If you go to Google Trends, search Barack Obama, go to 2001, see if his name appears anywhere except the Dean's List.
Right. Yeah, this idea of sentiment is so vital to understanding election swings and how you feel when you look at Biden versus how you feel when you look at Trump. Like, I know the younger generation, they look at Trump and they're just fucking amused. We talked about this the last time. My daughters don't have a negative sense toward him as much as they're sort of bemused by him. And they think that because of Trump, they don't really have a serious notion of what the president is or does. But they also don't have a notion of just how harmful and destructive he was to they think he's an asshole, but they think he's a clown. Whereas they look at Biden and they think they look at him, he might as well be 180 years old to them.
Yeah.
Seriously, they look at it, they're like, I can't believe this fucking doddering old fool. Yeah, at least the other guy was
children call him a doddering old fool.
Yeah.
Right out of their mouth.
Yeah, look at this doddering old fool. Us whippersnappers just don't jive
with
that.
He's not hip.
So I don't know, man.
It makes sense because even me and my roommate, I'll watch TikTok on her phone. So we'll sit together and watch TikTok. Credible, you know, it's kind of, yeah. We have, you know, a perfectly good TV, but mm-hmm. why not? And we were watching compilations of Bush being Bush and he's fucking hilarious. And mm-hmm. I know all the shit. But I said,
watch me hit this drive.
It's so good. And the one that was like, I'll never stop thinking of ways to hurt our right. American people. Like, we do that too. There's just so many that I was like, I kind of love him. I know he's a war criminal. I said, yep. I know he's a war criminal, but I kind of love him mm-hmm. because he, controversial, maybe not controversial opinion, was like, he really was. And sometimes he was trying to be funny. Like, occasionally he was fucking around. Or he just, one time he said, or one of the clips was like, fuck, what did he say? It was like, not to dodge the question, though it is pretty convenient for me. like, fucking hilarious. Like, he was like arbitrarily very funny, mostly unintentionally, but sometimes intentionally. And, you know, that's what his presidency, like we did that episode, what was it? Right Wing Rehab years ago, 3 years ago at this point, I don't know. But yeah, about his painting but that's his legacy now. It's not being a war criminal. Yep. You know, it's a comment or...
Cheney gets cast as the war criminal. He just gets cast as sort of like, you know, the...
The doddering fool, yeah. Yeah, but he's fucking funny.
He's like the governor. Did you ever see Benson? Did you ever watch that when you were little?
I don't think so.
No.
Olivia Benson?
No.
I know. I just don't know what Benson is.
So the governor in Benson... that Robert Guillaume worked for was Bush. He was just, you know, prone to gaffes, kind of silly, goofy. Like, that's how we see him in our mind's eye now. It's like, oh, the goofy guy that was president for a little while. When I've said it before, like, I was seriously bloodthirsty after 9/11. And it's amazing how my perception of him was changing in real time throughout that. Because during the election, I was like, this guy is an idiot. And then after 9/11, I actually saw him as like the swashbuckling cowboy. And I remember there was a Vanity Fair cover that one of those trifold covers that they, I don't know if they still do that or not, but those
sometimes.
The big Annie Leibovitz photo shoot. And it was Bush and his cabinet, basically. And so you had Rumsfeld, Cheney, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, and I wonder who else was on there. Anyway, and it was like he was in the middle of it with his, you know, like holding his big belt buckle. And I remember thinking,
is it like a WWE one.
It was so absurd that it felt like that. Like, and it was like, these are the fucking people that are going to exact our revenge. And I was like, fuck yeah.
Wow.
Awesome.
I was more Democratic as an 8-year-old than you were.
Probably.
I like actively hated
definitely.
Bush.
Of course.
And I used to watch all the Jib Jab videos.
Jib Jab.
Yeah, I would watch. I have some of them memorized from when I was a kid. I have a distinct memory of being in the library with my mom and, you know, looking at books. And there was one called Bushisms.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my mom, I was like, I want to take this out. And she was
that would be banned now.
She was like, no. I was 8. And she was like, no. And I was like, why? And she's like, you don't need that. So I think I was very politically charged.
I'm just looking up the... Vanity Fair archive.
No, I thought you were looking up Jib Jab. It's good to be in DC.
Let's see who else they would have put in this thing.
Was it actually Annie Leibovitz, the photographer? Like, or were you just using her as a placeholder?
Yeah, it was her.
I love her work.
Colin Powell, Dick Cheney. Yeah, there's Bush. Yep, spread out with his big belt buckle. Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld.
How many of these fuckers are still alive? All of them?
You know what? I don't remember the other. Oh, yeah. CIA director George Tenet. No, I can't make this out of who the other person is. At any rate. Yeah. And the sheen wore off pretty quickly. But it was when I think just the, you know, what happened, the impressions that certain events make on you really goes to determine, I think, what your proclivity is. And now, in this situation, we've never had a situation, at least in our lifetimes, where the former president is running again. And so you get to sort of bring up all of these weird memories and emotions that you have affixed to that particular time. and set them against the other one that's happening in real time.
Is
this bizarre?
This is the first time a former president has run non-consecutively or lost, and then have we had that before?
So only Grover Cleveland.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah. Well, Teddy Roosevelt, but he didn't lose. So Teddy served a term and three quarters, stepped down anyway, regretted it, ran after Taft as a progressive, as the bull moose, and then lost. I'm wondering if there were others that tried to make it again. I don't know. I don't think so. At any rate, I think that feeling of security, like you say, the nostalgia that we have for the isolation in a weird way, we all have a weird relationship with that period. What's interesting is that the MAGA crew has an even more bizarre relationship with that period that they have to reconcile in their minds, because their guy took credit for the vaccine and then didn't, and then did again, got vaccinated, probably got boosted, and then...
I'm sure he's up to date.
He's probably up to date, yeah. But then he had to walk it back and then walk away from it. They hate Anthony Fauci, but he didn't fire Fauci when he could have. He was his guy. He served at the pleasure of the president. So they have to kind of reconcile that fact,
strong
right?
Use of the word pleasure.
Yeah, at the displeasure of the president.
Or at Fauci's displeasure.
They kind of have to reconcile a whole host of things.
There's just no way they are.
That don't make any sense. The things that they hate that were his policies.
The things
the
tax that make
cuts
sense
for the wealthy.
Like Obama being president during 9/11. They're right. Not reconciling anything. They only see what they want to see.
Yeah. Well, that's just a straight up fact that they're getting wrong. Like that's just ridiculous. But they're actually working themselves in knots over trying to justify the recent history of knowing that their guy brought forward the vaccine and then told everybody to take it. And that's what he was working for until he wasn't.
I saw today that the advance of the mRNA vaccine really did a lot for research, because now they think they don't have to like chase strains anymore. So it's sort of like a breakthrough. So they think that the vaccine that they've made can essentially predict I'm not a scientist, so just regurgitating what I read, but can predict and or be efficacious enough to kill a new strain. So it's not like a new strain's here. We have to, you know,
right,
revitalize, refresh. They think
Does that inform how they think about the flu vaccine?
I think it informs how they think about all vaccines.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So, hey, at least he did it, sort of. At least someone did it.
Congratulations, Donald. But that's why I was trying to kind of rethink this, and I don't know, it hadn't occurred to me in these specific terms about, you know, him being seen in a positive light, his term being seen in a positive light, because his numbers have been shitty and he's been considered one of the worst presidents ever. And when I saw his favorability ratings increase, I was like, okay, let's think about this practically. Take the MAGA crew out of it and put the voted for Obama, then voted for Trump voters, which is probably where the pickup is coming from, right? That middle lane, maybe it's like a middle of the road, white suburban Rust Belt voter that went Obama, then went Trump, and doesn't really know what to do with themselves at this point. You've got the guy who's claiming he's a career union supporting hard scrabble Scranton boy, lessons from my dad, kind of, you know, talking the game that should appeal to that part of the country, trying to bring back manufacturing and actually succeeding. So we have a net increase in manufacturing jobs in this country, way more than the small increase that happened under Trump. And it's happening in the areas that Obama won and then, you know, Trump won. And they're looking at Trump and they're seeing something in him that has this level of nostalgia. And that's when it kind of hit me like a brick. Like, it's the socialist parts, it's the Keynesian parts of the Trump administration that now Biden's not getting credit for, even though he continued them. So with the same mind's eye, these voters can look at those programs as delivered under Biden and call him a socialist. And then the same exact program that was initiated under Trump, they look at it and say, that's the free market capitalist fighter, real talk fighter that I love so much. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. But if they were being honest with themselves, they would look at it and be like, yeah, all the shit that was done, that was extraordinary and beyond what capitalism could deliver, was socialist in nature. But nobody talks about that.
I don't know that most people are educated enough to clock it.
But that's not even in the, you know, Chris Hayes mainstream media type, you know, where is this narrative?
Because when we, you know, think about the way they talked about Bernie and socialism, right, it's not well received. Yeah. Because people equate socialism with communism. They just assume like socialism, communism, fascism, you're out of here.
Yeah, it's just amazing how it can come to the rescue so conveniently when everybody needs it. And then they're the same ones that look at it and be like, well, it's fine for me, but nobody else should get it.
It's what you've been saying all along of the pattern of, you know, Democratic president does good or marginally good, we'll say, and then either doesn't win re-election or it's their last term. And then the next president feels the effects of it. Like, I feel like you've talked about it throughout, I think, the Carter series, mm-hmm, other examples that I don't have on the top of my head.
Well, there are people that will say, well, yeah, because like anything good happening now was a policy that Trump established. It's not a Biden thing. Since everybody, so you use it as a convenient tool,
right,
to support whatever your narrative is. But
there's sort of no winning. We're this is just a extremely, I don't even know if there's a word for it. What type of society we live in?
Do you have a sense that the people who viscerally hate Biden hate him more than the people who even viscerally hate Trump? Like the antipathy, and I'm like, when I hear people criticizing Biden that I know, it's just dripping with venom. And I can't figure, like, I know why I don't like him,
right,
but their reasons are totally different. And I can't figure, like, do you have a sense that like those negatives, that his negatives are even higher maybe than Trump's?
No, but only because, so I'm not on Facebook, so I think there's a lot of rhetoric that gets shared there. So maybe like my, you know, random acquaintances I know that would be inclined to post on Facebook, I don't see that. I, for good or for bad, my bubble is a bubble,
mm-hmm,
and we are a group of young progressive people.
Yeah.
And then when I'm in polite company, we don't really talk about it, you know. So I have friends who are Republican in name, who I would do think are socially liberal, blah, 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 you know, not hateful people, otherwise they wouldn't be my friends. But I don't know where they stand now. You know, they definitely don't like Biden,
yeah,
because they didn't vote for him. But I don't know, like, I don't even know. I avoid it, which, because,
mm-hmm,
I'm afraid, mostly because I'm afraid. Yeah. I don't want to hear that they're like, well, how bad could it be? I don't want to hear that. That would terrify me. So I don't know. And I don't have very many of those friends. And then, you know, my other groups where I'm like, we're all sort of liberal, but I don't really know. I'm like, we're all definitely on the left, but I'm like, are you on the center? So I'm always treading very lightly as to not be the one who's, you know, putting my foot in my mouth. So it's really hard. I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good sense of it. I don't have a sense of any, like, I know who, you know, I know who I'm voting for. I know who my roommate will vote for. I know who my sister will vote for, and, you know, some close friends. But then outside of that, I'm like, I don't think most of them will vote for Trump, but they just might not vote.
Right.
I don't know.
I do think there's going to be a lot of people that sit out. I don't think the get out the vote will be as big this year as it was the last time.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, I think RFK fucks this whole thing up.
That's one thing I'm grateful I only read about it. I don't hear about it from other people. I don't have anyone in my network talking about him.
Mm-mm.
So
I do. I do.
You also,
very,
I mean,
definitively.
You are more open-minded than I am about being friends with people who don't have the same values as you. I don't mean that in a slight. You just, I mean, you're older.
I've collected more people.
Yes, exactly. Right. And, you know, you interact with more people because of your kids. And, mm-hmm, you know, I can just easily not engage with people that I don't know and don't want to get to know. So you know, it's probably a much better gauge what you hear than what I hear, because I'm talking to a bunch of people who, you know, also would be pro-communism.
Well, yeah, I do. Well, and also I am on the outskirts of the city and you're in the city.
Yeah, but my friends, you know, we're all kind of from the same area. We just all, it's the blank to Manhattan pipeline, mm-hmm. or the blank to Brooklyn pipeline. Right. I mean, it's all homogenous, you mm-hmm. know?
Just as a bridge to both of the pieces that we put there, we 99 pulled a couple of comments that came off of YouTube. So we, like I said, this week I got like, I would say 80% of the way complete with the part three of the series. But these things, the Trump thing and the AOC piece, really caught my attention and pulled me off from completing those. So I wanted to get those out, put them up on YouTube before we consolidated them into this episode. So we do have a couple of comments already about them. Why don't we head over to YouTube and start with the Trump bump video?
Yeah, so Lori H. said, "The last few moments of what he said needs to be amplified and repeated over and over again. Good job, Max. You have a way with words."
Thanks so much. What was I saying in the last few moments? Let's see.
You said stinky fucker. Probably another gross pun about assholes.
Which you didn't like that ass? You no, didn't like that
I
one?
It was disgusting.
Did you really?
Yes.
Either pucker up or stink?
I understand.
It was my favorite line of the whole thing.
I know it would be. But something about the word pucker makes me sick uh-huh. in that context. No, in all contexts. What's one good context for the word pucker?
Just that one. That's a great context.
I commend pucker your up, word. Buttercup. I commend your wordplay.
Thank you.
But it made me nauseous.
Yay. Oh, all Trump's socialist policies.
Yes. Did you know that?
What's that?
It's actually, you're supposed to say nauseated if you're talking about your own feelings.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'm really smart.
If you're actually sick to your stomach, it's nauseous, right?
No, nauseated.
Like, and then...
Don't ask me what
that nauseates me. I thought there was... Oh, you don't have to look it up.
No, I want to look it
Unfuckers
up.
Unfuckers will let us know.
No, because I said something... I made a fact. I said something definitively, and I want to fact check my thing.
Yeah, so it was all about Trump's little policies there and how they're socialist. And then GA6013 said, "Geez, why did I even click on this video? Someone else who just regurgitates." Okay. Well, GA6013, you're definitely not listening to this. So I'm sorry you didn't like it. Sorry you didn't like it.
Okay. Technically, one cannot feel nauseous, because nauseous describes the feeling of being sick. If an individual is feeling sick to one's stomach, they could say that they were feeling nauseated. So nauseous is like the description. Nauseated is the thing.
Yeah, all right.
One of my podcasts, they were using the word oscillate and making fun of other people who were using it. Mm-hmm. And I really want to write in and be like, the word you should be using is vacillate. I don't want them to roll their eyes at me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just a fun fact.
Do you want to vacillate or oscillate through these comments now?
Well, we should talk about the AOC video and then talk about the comments.
Yeah. So the AOC video. Do I just have rose-colored glasses when it comes to her? Or is she truly growing into... I think she is going to be special. Like, I think she's
already special.
Special in the way that we, you know, view her and the way people talk about her. I mean, she's carved out of, but I think in terms of her prowess as a legislator and a, like a political figure that's going to move, like really create momentum in this country, I think she's on the way to becoming like very special.
She's very accessible.
Yeah.
And I think that sets her apart for sure. You know, I know people who live in her district and they can go see her. And, you know, even some of the other legislators around them don't do anything. Like, I see people online being like, "I wrote to AOC's office and they got back to me." And obviously it's not her answering those emails, but, you know, you are who you surround yourself with in a way. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it was, I mean, could it have been anyone else? I think that's a good question. She sort of took off. Circumstances, be what they may, could it have been one of the other squad members taking her place? Do you think it was her who set herself apart, or
the fame is following? She's the package, and being as shallow as it sounds, she is very, very appealing.
I think all of the squad are beautiful, though.
And she's, I think, the most broadly appealing in that way. And I think that's the piece. I think her looks is what the right was seizing on because...
Right. She's too sexy to do anything.
Right. I mean,
God forbid.
We did that montage.
Montage.
We're going out to montage this weekend.
We did that montage early on of... it was Tucker and then Shapiro. Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro. I mean, tripping over themselves, doing anything that they could to get her to appear on their shows because it was so salacious the way that they were going about it. And they were denigrating her. And they were, I mean, it was such a misogynistic approach, but you could tell it's because they're just fascinated by her beauty and the fact that she's really smart, really capable. And that's why I think some of them have backed off because she's bringing the receipts when she does these. It's very hard to attack her, like to clip her, right? I think it's very difficult to clip her and mock her like you can with some other, like you can clip Ilhan Omar because she looks different. We're already, you know, we have this anti-Muslim sentiment that's pervasive in this country. And she's saying things that, because she's Muslim, will definitely hit the ear wrong. There's some others that you can clip that I think are...
Let's not lay out everyone's flaws. Give them fodder.
Okay.
I understand what you're saying, though.
I think you can... I'm trying to think of the other... You know, Ayanna Pressley, you know, now she's come forward with her battle with alopecia. Like, and you know, they can clip her and they're just mocking her without even mocking her because they know that that's going to appeal to their audience. If you try to clip AOC now, you're not going to get something that's really going to be so offensive. She's so measured and so thoughtful in her remarks. And when she's doing these and when she's conducting her questions at the hearings, she's really fucking good at it.
I can
tell she's totally prepared.
I think that does a slight disservice to the others. Because you're saying they can't clip her because she's smart. And you're saying they can clip them because they have differences. So I don't think that's a fair characterization.
It's not. No, it's not fair. But I'm saying it. There's nothing now about her that plays into either their racist stereotypes and she doesn't give them an inch anywhere. Because... she looks great. She sounds great. She's saying all the right things. And she's bringing it.
I don't know. I've seen them make fun of her for posting a selfie, like going out on date night and making fun of her for that,
right,
for being too millennial. So,
right,
you know, no one's infallible or people who want to drag people down will do it regardless.
But this move, this money move, I think this marks a big change. And It's a serious professional change that it's kind of an announcement of sorts. It's not the most amount of money that you could imagine, you know, somebody bringing forward. But to say that just for her to take the step to drop money into defending democracy, but give it to the Democratic Party is a pretty bold move that we wouldn't have seen before because she's always been at odds with it. And it sort of announces her presence of this is the beginning of me taking over the party. And I've arrived.
She's got, what, 2 more years till she can be president?
Oh, yeah, that's right. There you go. I wonder what would happen. She certainly has the fundraising ability. If she went for one of the Senate seats in New York, the backlash against that would be enormous at first because the New York State Democratic Party would work against her.
And whose seat would she even take?
Either. I mean, at some point... you would have to imagine Schumer is going to move on at some point and become, I don't know.
MSNBC host.
No, I was going to say this guy's going to get paid like $1 billion a year from one of the big banks. He's just going to make so much fucking money on Wall Street. It's incredible. If he wants.
I don't know, but he loves talking.
Hmm?
He loves talking.
He does. I mean, they could give him.
He's a yapper.
He could, he could be on this CNBC Squawk or whatever the fuck it is all the time, you know,
from
the bank's perspective. But yeah, I mean, so that would be the path, I guess, in theory. And she could make a lot of strides in the next few years to set herself up to be able to be in that position if all of a sudden she's kind of directing traffic with funds within the party. So if she's the one that basically helps support the Democratic victories to return the seats in New York, that's kind of a big fuck you to the New York Democratic establishment that also they really can't ignore.
Yeah.
So I just
don't knock a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah, I don't think that she.
I don't like that phrase.
I think that she is setting herself up. She's playing such a long game, and she's setting herself up in multiple areas. One is not to be shut down or not defended when the shit hits the fan and APAC comes after all the squad members. Like, it's going to be hard to not help and also pony up for her and her members.
Another horse reference.
Pony up, yes.
What are you looking at?
The other thing, I'm looking into the sky.
Thought you were looking at the wasp from yesterday. You scared me.
Is it still around?
I don't know, but you scared me.
I'm sorry. And I think she's setting herself up for whatever the future might hold for her to maybe take a Senate seat at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's just, there's just no way it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think New York City would just, I mean, it would be like a presidential election. I mean, she would just overwhelm
when she runs. I mean, there was someone who opposed her this year. It was just like a fucking nut job.
Yeah.
And maybe got, I don't know, some votes, but
mm-hmm.
people love her. I mm-hmm. see her face plastered around all the time.
Mm-hmm. So the comments that we got on YouTube about her little power play. First one comes from Nathan Sirst, who said, Max once again proves why he's the voice of reason among leftists. Now, that's according to somebody who's closer to the middle and to the right in Nathan Sirst, yeah? So I appreciate
gotten him
that.
Over.
Yeah, to some degree.
We also,
but there are leftists that would wholly disagree with this being
a
voice of reason take.
All leftists want to be the voice of reason.
I don't think so.
You don't? You don't think the left any...
No, like I still follow Lee Camp, and Lee has no desire to be the voice of reason.
Fair. I guess... people in your shoes.
Radical Eleanor doesn't want to be the voice of reason.
I guess what I meant more by that was like the voice of the mainstream. Not in a bad way.
Mm.
It, like what leftists
the
should
right
want.
Take.
Yeah, that's what I
the
think.
Correct take.
Yes, yes, the correct take.
Yeah.
IE said, oh, that AOC. I have high hopes for her. Hopefully she doesn't pull a long-term Fetterman. That too turned quick.
Boy, did he ever. Man.
He was like, I'm not progressive.
There are people, so I've watched a couple of people that say, oh, we saw that coming. There were signs there at the beginning. And I remember when we first covered him and you and I were kind of going back and forth and struggling with the whole pull the shotgun on, you know, on a black man in his neighborhood kind of thing. And I was like, that wasn't awesome. And then again, we don't live there. Hard to talk about the circumstances. It was a he said, they said kind of thing and what have you. It was like, okay, well, all the other things seem to be pointing to something. I don't know. But I definitely feel like I was snookered by the rhetoric rather than the actions and the person.
Maybe he just got inside the system and realized it's not worth it.
Such a radical departure, though. I mean...
You think he was just fully masquerading? That seems almost harder than just giving up.
I don't know. I mean, the APAC turn was the first big turn, right? That at least we got wind of. That they wrote his policy statement. And that he ran it past them to edit it. And they gave notes. They gave him a red line copy. And then he took that copy and put it up. And that was his... And was like, wait, what? And that's what kind of where it all started. And then I think, so either this was him all along and he knew how to play the long game to get elected because he was reading, you know, the room at the moment, or he got so fucking angry at being browbeaten by the left over that one particular move that he just said, you know what, go fuck yourselves. I don't know. It's really hard to tell. AOC.
I can email him, see if he wanted to be on the show.
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome.
Maybe he'll do it.
Sure.
I'll do it.
Okay.
I'm
gonna say, what's your fucking problem, dude?
Yeah, it'll be funny. Not like ha-ha funny, but...
The last comment here so far is Torrential Rage said, I get frustrated when the holier-than-thou online leftists demand purity from her. They want her to be an activist, accomplish nothing, and burn out. Definitely the thesis of that particular piece. Anyway, that's a wrap on this part. So, like I said, I was 80% done with the narrative for part three of the border crisis. The part three takes a macro and then a micro look at the economics of migration. So I wanted to put, so Maureen Meyer, I thought was terrific because she was really able to contextualize the political economies and some standout political economies. This
and
next piece,
fixed her audio.
Thank you. I believe so. I didn't actually go back and listen to it after you replaced it.
I spot checked it.
Does it sound okay?
I mean, I saw the levels go from really, really high to normal. So.
Okay, good. Yeah, so...
we did an oopsie.
I did an oopsie. And this is what happens when I try to get creative in the studio and don't rely on the professionals that actually know how to do this stuff. So the levels, if you listen to the original drop, the levels on Maureen Meyer's interview were peaking and very distracting. And so we exported them again, and 99 put them up, and they sound much better now. So won't do that again. My apologies for anybody that actually suffered through that, because if you had headphones on, it actually hurts. So we redid that. And I think what was great about Maureen is, like I said, she was able to give some very deep historical and present-day context for the political economies in Latin American countries. And then this week, what we're going to do, or next week rather, we're going to take a look at the purely economic conditions. Some of it related to the fallout from the political interventions from the U.S. and the lack of attention that the U.S. has given it. We're going to talk about how the last 30 years, China has invested heavily in the Latin American and Caribbean, but in the last 10 years, they've invested heavily through infrastructure projects, and that's changing some of the dynamic on the ground, and how different parts of the LAC. And I have to say, I'm really, it should be just Latin America, because I'm excluding a lot of the Caribbean islands because their economies tend to be so specific, meaning, you know, sole source, like, you know, Cuba really just relying on sugar, and other, you know, the Virgin Islands relying on tourism, the Cayman Islands relying on finance. These kind of single sole sourced economies are a little bit of an outlier, and they don't contribute enough to the overall picture to actually have a demonstrable effect on the GDP numbers. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at Central America, looking at South America, looking at the LAC region as a whole, trying to create a comparative analysis between how big these places are compared to, let's say, the European economy, the Asian economy, and North American economy. A little light work on the trade agreements, even though I don't go as heavily into it, because what I'm trying to really get after here is how the lack of a concentrated and long-term economic strategy from the U.S. perspective has impacted individual economies, made them susceptible to shocks, be they political, climate, resource shocks, market shocks, and how that contributes to the migration crisis. So I'm finding it all rather fascinating, as you could probably tell. And hopefully I can tie this thing up neatly with a bow, and then we'll move on from there. And as the summer heats up, obviously the political reporting is just going to get nuttier and nuttier. So I am anxious to get this done, get it wrapped, and try to put some context to it, because when we look at the overriding sources of voter mobility, you know, what's going to get people to the polls, a lot of people are still claiming that the border crisis is one of their top. Yeah, I don't believe, I don't understand it, and I don't really believe it unless you live in a border town. Like, I really think that this is for pollsters and not for people.
If you go to my roommates from Staten Island, it's a big problem there.
So I don't think it's a big issue in Wisconsin. I don't think it's a big issue in Ohio, in Michigan.
No, I know. I was just giving a New York example of, like, yeah, you talk to those people and they're like, get these fucking immigrants out of here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All of Long Island, Staten Island, and even probably some parts of Queens and Manhattan, you know?
Yeah, there's
certainly the Bronx. The Bronx has most of the intake,
there's
actually.
People who don't like immigrants everywhere.
Yeah, and, you know,
shocking.
But the immigrants that don't like immigrants are kind of amazing. So I have been going out of my, I know this sounds really crazy, and people think that there's something wrong with me, but I.
Wait, there's not?
Yeah. I mean, there is.
Okay.
But strangers don't know that at first glance. I look pretty normal. You know what I mean? I am going out of my way, because I've told you I live in a town and I work in a town that
you live in a town?
Predominantly Spanish, and predominantly Central American at that. I am going out of my way to talk to as many people as I can about their home countries. And I have yet to find anyone who will criticize Bukele in El Salvador or the turn that is beginning to happen in Ecuador, a little bit in Honduras. Nobody will criticize any of the hard right turns. And I get it. I totally get it. And it's one of those things that we don't think about, we don't factor in. And there's two pieces of the criticism. One is they like what's happening with clamping down on violence and crime and cartels in their home countries. That makes total sense. They see through that lens a correlation with Donald Trump. They may not be able to vote for him, but they don't dislike Donald Trump. So these are people who migrated to this country, who were insulted along the way by the person that had that office, who's running again, but they see that type of strong hand. It's like they're not mad that he didn't want them here, if that makes sense. They get it. They're not mad. And they're more naturally aligned because I think of their Catholic devotion and the paternalistic structure of a lot of these cultures. They're more naturally aligned with what they hear and understand the Republican Party to be. And they look at this pseudo faux strongman at the top and they're like, well, I recognize that guy, you know, and I don't criticize the guy that I'm coming from. So there's so much more to say about that, because like, I don't understand why the Republican Party hasn't fucking figured out that their most natural allies are coming across the border. If they just, like Bush understood it.
Like, possible that these people don't want to talk to a strange white man and give him the opening to criticize their country and people.
If you ask a Spanish person,
hey, 99, now I get to play word police, because Max, you shouldn't be saying Spanish person, referring to someone from anywhere but Spain, Spanish speaking person, perhaps, but a Spanish person is from Spain. So you're talking about folks that are from Latin American or Southern American countries. As I'm sure you know, this is just a boomery slip of the tongue, but these folks should be referred to as Hispanic or Latino or Latinx or Spanish-speaking, but not Spanish. Comprende?
Here comes a broad generalization.
Okay.
I'm teasing you.
My experience.
I'm teasing you.
I know. If you ask a Spanish person,
again, Hispanic or Latino or Spanish speaking, carry on.
In Spanish, what they think of their president from their home country and name the president by name, you have them at hello.
You humble bragging that you speak Spanish?
100%. Yeah.
This is a new reveal for you.
I speak enough Spanish to be dangerous. So they're so anxious to talk about it because nobody would even think to know, like, to name their president, you
it's
know?
Fair. I was just asking. Because, like...
My daughter's calling.
Oh, hi.
Hi, I love you. Can I call you back in 3 minutes? Love you, bye.
If I was in a different country, well... okay. It depends. Because I'm a white person. So I'm not really afraid of people being racist to me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe we could you go the Judaism route.
Yeah.
And if someone was like, you're Jewish, what do you think of this? I mean, I would openly not condone Netanyahu, so that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But in theory, I can imagine me being like, am I just opening the door for anti-Semitism? That's why I mm-hmm. asked that question.
Yeah.
But that's a fair answer.
Yeah, I think it catches people off guard. And I've found that the
answer... They're just surprised you're talking to them because no one talks to each other for that's good
right.
reason.
That's right. And that's partially why people look like, oh boy, what's coming now? But the genuine enthusiasm for Bukele in particular has surprised me. It really has. And I think... So just like in 2016... when there were really obvious signs out there that there was something really amiss, but we were just so blinded by the media narrative that we didn't see it coming. That's, I think, what's making me really nervous now about twofold. One, RFK and what he peels off and who he peels off from, and how the antipathy towards Biden and the mistrust about his age is causing some people who hate Trump to look for something else. And you know what? I could do worse than RFK. And you know, I didn't love the vaccine mandate. They might not hate the vaccine, but they might have hated the mandate. Like, there's a full spectrum of people out there on both sides.
Now that you're saying it, the people I was talking about before,
yeah,
they could they could vote for RFK because they were those type of people who were like not into the mandates.
Yeah.
I never, that didn't.
A lot of healthcare workers, they hated the mandates because they didn't want to get fired.
Yeah,
a lot of people in service industry that were against the mandates because they didn't want to get fired, you know. Public sector employees, a lot of union employees.
Get fired like the Google employees got fired for protesting.
Yeah, like them. Yeah.
Which is fucked up. I can't believe they did that. I mean, I can believe it, but I can't believe they did it.
Yeah. Google, not a nice company. Not sure people are aware of that.
Yeah. How can you fire people? And then I follow like an account that talks about like tech news. And they asked for what we're talking about. This like 20 Google employees and other outsiders staged a sit-in protesting Google's contract with Israel. And they got fired, I think, today as of recording, or maybe yesterday. And the poll that I saw, which I thought would be like but who am I kidding? Tech bros?
Mm.
But it was like, do you think they should have fired them? Do you not think they should have fired them? 70 people said yes, they should have fired them. That floored me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's actual repercussions sometimes, but for good actions.
Yeah.
That was just a segue. I wanted to talk about it because I'm angry on their behalf.
I mean, we could segue from there to the leaks that came out of the New York Times that said that certain words that were prohibited in their coverage, genocide being one of them, ethnic cleansing being another, and
which you clocked
territory.
You clocked it really early.
Yeah. And there were, because there were some really smart pieces that were, I mean, The Intercept was doing that from Jump Street. It was like, because they knew from past coverage that it was going to be really important to do the word count and look at the language in these pieces, and then just the actual number, the volume of pieces coming out. But yeah, there's so many different places. There's so many different roads we can go down. But again, my fear is people that criticize Biden for his coverage of Israel, for how he's litigated
he said,
this with Israel,
stop.
they might see themselves voting for Trump, and in which case, it's going to be worse off for the Palestinians.
Worse off is the understatement of the year.
The people who know that might think that there is safety and solace in somebody like RFK, who's going to take a very pro-Israel stance, but also a pro-humanist stance, so he has said, and an isolationist stance.
Trump
that might actually be appealing to
pro-Palestine, and then he'd win.
If Trump went pro-Palestine, what does he lose?
The Kushners.
So he loses the coastal areas, which he's lost already. All of the fake evangelicals, they're not moved, right? All of the fake Israeli-loving evangelicals, they're not really moved by that. They don't really give a shit because they're anti-Semitic at their core. If Trump goes pro-Pal, holy shit, that could seal the fucking deal. That could seal the deal.
That or immigration. He could. All he has to do is flip a switch, make it work for him like he always does.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think he has to flip the switch on immigration. I think he wins that battle all
True.
Day, every day. I think he's winning it and he wins it
but, I mean,
going away.
If
to quote a phrase you love.
Yes. If he the people on the fence in the similar way of like young people who are so pro-Palestine or young people who are so pro-immigration. You know, maybe there's like a new tapping a new demographic.
See, I think he wins. I think he wins the Palestine for anybody who's on the fence issue, because he, in the same way that he wins Russia, Ukraine, all you need to know is it wouldn't have happened on my watch because everyone's afraid of me.
Because mm-hmm.
nothing
he's
happened
with Putin.
Because nothing happened on my watch. I'm better friends with Netanyahu and I'm better friends with Putin than both of these guys were. And all I would have had to do is say no.
Yeah, he'd be like, they're eating out of the palm of my hand.
Mm-hmm. So I think he wins. I think he wins those either way. But I think the people that are rational enough to understand that it's all bullshit coming from his side would see something appealing. Again, if you think about if RFK really pulls 10 to 15%, which is what he's polling at, if he really pulls those kind of numbers, it is the most substantial independent bid that we've had in our lifetime.
Is he the
fucking
most
amazing
prolific candidate that we've had in terms of, I'm not saying that he's done anything super prolific. Is prolific done? I don't even know if that's the right word.
I'm not sure.
Legacy. He's the most legacied candidate in terms of family.
Yeah.
Third party.
He has the most profound name, I suppose, even though he has zero experience.
Right, but I'm saying people might just innately be like, oh, Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah. If we think about other monumental third-party challenges, Ross Perot, and before that, Ralph Nader. And before that, you'd have to go back a long way.
Nader
had a huge political legacy. He was a very much of that moment. Okay. Ross Perot, not so much. Ross Perot was just like I think people were looking at the field and they were so disappointed with the field, which again also plays into today. It was such a lackluster field that they were like, yeah, okay, well, oh, maybe this fucking weirdo, you know? Jeez, I don't know. The whole thing makes me very fucking nervous.
He's not going to be pro-Palestine, so we don't have to worry about that. But if it happens, I said it first. Pay me, I guess? ? You're welcome and I'm sorry.
I'd like to thank 99 for laying out the strategy, my path to victory. Pro-Palestine. Now I'd like to nuke them.
And then he also declares the world is vegan. All Big Macs are vegan. I did arrows.
I've finished all the Big Macs. They're all gone. I've eaten them all. Now you're vegan. You're welcome. 99, you're my vice president.
I wonder who his VP is going to be. I can't wait. Let's go.
This girl right here.
Oh, can I have a job in the administration?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you.
I'm going to put you in charge of a HUD.
Cool. All right. Following in the footsteps of my hero, Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Don't forget, spread the word about the newsletter. Get that thing out there. Share it with people. Say, you should sign up for this newsletter. Also, become a member if you're not a member. If you can't afford to be a member, again, spread the love about the newsletter. Leave us a review, a comment, anything. Just get involved, all right? That's it.
Get your hands dirty.
Get your hands dirty, that's right. Thanks, 99. Thank you, Manny. Catch you all next week.